I hear your challenge. I hear it. Please, tell me more now about life on this planet on a grander scale. Tell me how nation can get along with nation so there'll be war no more.
There will always be disagreements between nations, for disagreement is merely a sign, and a healthy one, of individuality. Violent resolution of disagreements, however, is a sign of extraordinary immaturity. There is no reason in the world why violent resolution cannot be avoided, given the willingness of nations to avoid it. One would think that the massive toll in death and destroyed lives would be enough to produce such willingness, but among primitive cultures such as yours, this is not so. As long as you think you can win an argument, you will have it. As long as you think you can win a war, you will fight it.
What is the answer to all of this?
I don't have an answer. I only have...
I know. An observation.
Yes. I observe now what I observed before. A short-term answer could be to establish what some have called a one-world government, with a world court to settle disputes, one whose verdicts may not be ignored, as happens with the present world court, and a world peacekeeping force to guarantee that no one nation, no matter how powerful or how influential, can ever again aggress upon another. Yet understand that there may still be violence upon the earth. The peacekeeping force may have to use violence to get someone to stop doing so. As I noted in Book 1, failure to stop a despot empowers a despot. Sometimes the only way to avoid a war is to have a war. Sometimes you have to do what you don't want to do in order to ensure that you won't have to keep on doing it. This apparent contradiction is part of the divine dichotomy, which says that sometimes the only way to ultimately be a thing, in this case peaceful, may be at first to not be it. In other words, often the only way to know yourself as that which you are is to experience yourself as that which you are not. It is an observable truth that power in your world can no longer rest disproportionately with any individual nation, but must rest in the hands of the total group of nations existing on this planet. Only in this way can the world finally be at peace, resting in the secure knowledge that no one despot, no matter how big or powerful his individual nation, can or will ever again infringe upon the territories of another nation, nor threaten her freedoms. No longer need the smallest nations depend upon the goodwill of the largest nations, often having to bargain away their own resources and offer their prime lands for foreign military bases in order to earn it. Under this new system, the security of the smallest nations will be guaranteed not by whose back they scratch, but by who is backing them. All 160 nations would rise up should one nation be invaded. All 160 nations would say no should one nation be violated or threatened in any way. Similarly, nations would no longer be threatened economically, blackmailed into certain courses of action by their bigger trading partners, required to meet certain guidelines in order to receive foreign aid, or mandated to perform in certain ways in order to qualify for simple humanitarian assistance. Yet there are those among you who would argue that such a system of global governance would erode the independence and the greatness of individual nations. The truth is, it would increase it, and that is precisely what the largest nations, whose independence is assured by power, not by law or justice, are afraid of. For then no longer would only the largest nation always get its way automatically, but the considerations of all nations would have to be heard equally. And no longer would the largest nations be able to control and hoard the mass of the world's resources, but would be required to share them more equally, render them accessible more readily, provide their benefits more uniformly to all the world's people. A worldwide government would level the playing field, and this idea, while driving to the core of the debate regarding basic human dignity, is anathema to the world's haves, who want the have-nots to go seek their own fortunes, ignoring, of course, the fact that the haves control all that others would seek.
Yet it feels as though we're talking about redistribution of wealth here. How can we maintain the incentive of those who do want more and are willing to work for it if they know they must share with those who do not care to work that hard?
First, it's not merely a question of those who want to work hard and those who don't. That is a simplistic way to cast the argument, usually constructed in that way by the haves.
It is more often a question of opportunity than willingness. So the real job, and the first job in restructuring the social order, is to make sure each person and each nation has equal opportunity. That can never happen so long as those who currently possess and control the mass of the world's wealth and resources hold tightly to that control.
Yes, I mentioned Mexico. And without wanting to get into nation bashing, I think this country provides an excellent example of that. A handful of rich and powerful families control the wealth and resources of that entire nation, and have for 40 years. Elections in this so-called Western democracy are a farce, because the same families have controlled the same political party for decades, assuring virtually no serious opposition. Result? The rich get richer, and the poor get poorer. If wages should jump from $1.75 to a whopping $3.15 an hour, the rich point out how much they've done for the poor in providing jobs and opportunity for economic advancement. Yet the only ones making quantum advances are the rich, the industrialists and business owners who sell their commodities on the national and world market at huge profits, given the low cost of their labor. America's rich know this is true, which is why many of America's rich and powerful are rebuilding their plants and factories in Mexico and other foreign countries where slave labor wages are considered a grand opportunity for the peasants. Meanwhile, these workers toil in unhealthy and oceans, but the local government, controlled by the same few reaping the profits from these ventures, imposes few regulations. Health and safety standards and environmental protections are virtually non-existent in the workplace. The people are not being cared for, nor is the earth on which they are being asked to live in their paper shacks next to streams in which they do their laundry and into which they sometimes defecate, for indoor plumbing is often also not one of their dignities. What is created by such crass disregard for the masses is a population which cannot afford the very products it is manufacturing. But the rich factory owners don't care. They can ship their goods to other nations where there are people who can. Yet I believe that sooner or later, this spiral will turn in upon itself, with devastating consequences, not just in Mexico, but wherever humans are exploited.
Revolutions and civil war are inevitable, as are wars between nations, so long as the haves continue seeking to exploit the have-nots under the guise of providing opportunity.
Holding on to the wealth and the resources has become so institutionalized that it almost now appears acceptable, even to some fair-minded people who see it as simply open-market economics.
Yet only the power held by the world's wealthy individuals and nations makes that illusion of fairness possible. The truth is, it is not fair to the largest percentage of the world's people and nations who are held down from even attempting to achieve what the powerful have achieved. The system of governance described here would drastically shift the balance of power away from the resource-rich to the resource-poor, forcing the resources themselves to be fairly shared.
That is what the powerful fear.
Yes. So the short-term solution to the world's foment may be a new social structure, a new worldwide government.